What is Zionism? What is its history? And what is its opposition, anti-Zionism? And what constitutes this history? The conversation has gotten so loud, yet it seems people don't really know the definitions of the terms themselves. It's time to cut through the rhetoric, noise, slogans, and soundbites and offer the debate an intelligible context. Join us to journey through the historical roots of this debate.
The State of Israel was born not after the Holocaust so that never again. The State of Israel was intended to be born by the Zionist leaders before so that never at all.
In each episode, we will explore how every type of Zionist thought was opposed by a certain brand of anti-Zionism. And we reflect on how these various debates persist to this day. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 5, our final episode of Zionism and Anti-Zionism, the history of two opposing ideas. Let's take stock of where we're at. In the 19th century, Zionism emerged as a political liberation movement to achieve self-determination for the Jewish people in their indigenous homeland. It was secular and socialist in nature. With the establishment of the modern state of Israel, Zionism had achieved its goal. With this, the intra-Jewish debate ended. In the last episode, we spoke about the origins of Arab and Islamic anti-Zionism. The moment that seven Arab armies invaded the newly established Jewish state in 1948 with the goal of eliminating it was the moment that Zionism and anti-Zionism went to war. The opposition between these two ideas has characterized the conflict ever since. We also covered how the misdiagnosis of Israel as a foreign entity necessarily requires a twisting of reality and the reshuffling of cause and effect. Now we turn from the Arab to the Western world, where anti-Zionism has become a central pillar of left-wing identity, especially in progressive spaces. So how did we get here? In our fifth and final episode, we consider contemporary left-wing anti-Zionism and its roots in Soviet anti-Zionism. That such an anti-Semitic cartoon was published by the New York Times in 2019 doesn't make sense until you see these. Cartoons from the Soviet era that date decades back, which demonstrate the roots of left-wing anti-Zionism in the West today. Here's the historical breakdown.
The Soviet Union really doesn't get sufficient credit for its contribution to anti-Zionism. And of course, it goes back even further. It starts with anti-Semitism. Tsarist Russia made the most important contribution to anti-Semitism when it published the well-known forgery of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
In episode 2, we talked a bit about anti-Semitism in Tsarist Russia and the early Soviet Union. Just to recap, after the assassination of Tsar Alexander II in 1881, which was falsely blamed on Jews, a wave of anti-Semitic legislation was passed, and pogroms against Jewish communities broke out. Jews were being massacred. They couldn't travel freely, use land outside the Pale of Settlement, or enter into most academic institutions. Between 1903 and 1905, a watershed moment in modern anti-Semitism occurred. The infamous Protocols of the Elders of Zion was published in Russia. This book claimed to possess proof of a conspiracy that the Jews were controlling the world. Today, we know the book to be a forgery that was supported by the Russian state. Nonetheless, for the next several decades after the book's release and translation into several languages, the protocols would be used to justify anti-Semitic activity. After several more pogroms, blood libels, and anti-Semitic restrictions on Jewish life, the Bolshevik Revolution took place in 1917. That year,
the Bolsheviks released their Declarations of the Rights of the People of Russia, codifying that all nationalities will have equality. However, Lenin did not explicitly name the Jews, suggesting his belief that the Jews were not a nation. In 1918 and 1919, two interesting phenomena take place. On the one hand, the Soviet state declared that anti-Semitism is fatal to the cause of the revolution. On the other hand, Jews were expected to reject Zionism and Bundism and give up any sort of traditional religious Jewish practice. By 1930, though, this prohibition expanded to secular Jewish life as well. Cultural autonomy or any form of Jewish particularism and distinctiveness was undermined. Between 1936 and 1938, anti-Jewish violence re-emerged in the form of Stalin's purges against leading political and cultural figures who he deemed threatening. World War II reoriented the Soviet Union's focus. Hundreds of thousands of Jews fought for the Soviet Union against the Nazis, while over a million Soviet Jews perished during the Nazi occupation of Soviet lands. In the immediate wake of World War II, the Soviets were initially supportive of the creation of the State of Israel. They saw an opportunity to unseat Western influence in the Middle East. Soviet Jews were elated as well, with many interested in emigrating to Israel. However, the relationship between the two states soon soured as Israel grew closer with the US and the Soviet Union grew closer with hostile Arab states. At this point, the Soviet Union also shut its borders to Jewish emigration. Anti-Semitism in the form of purges, the shutting down of synagogues, and new conspiracy theories continued throughout the 1950s and 1960s. The 1967 war was another watershed moment in the relationship, since the Soviets had supported the defeated Arab armies, especially Egypt. In the wake of the war, anti-Zionist propaganda ran wild, including many comparisons between Israelis and Nazis. The Soviets also took their anti-Zionist campaign to the international sphere, spearheading an effort that came to fruition in 1975. The United Nations passed a resolution declaring that Zionism was a form of racism, a resolution that was only revoked a decade and a half later. At the same time, in the 1970s, there was a growing international pressure on the Soviet Union to permit Jewish emigration. The Soviets gave in, albeit reluctantly and gradually. Only about 250,000 Jews were given exit visas in the first decade after the policy change. And remember, there were almost 2.5 million Jews in the Soviet Union at the time. Those who were not permitted to leave were known as the refuseniks. Leading refuseniks were often arrested and held in prison without trial. A global campaign to free the refuseniks and support their emigration to Israel was launched. Natan Sharansky, a Soviet Jew, was a leader of the refuseniks. Sharansky was denied an exit visa to Israel in 1973 and then arrested in 1977 by the KGB for supposedly sharing state secrets with the West. He was tortured and subjected to solitary confinement until his release in 1986, thanks in large part to the international campaign launched by his wife, Avital. Sharansky eventually emigrated to Israel and became a member of the Knesset and leader of the former Soviet Union immigrant community. Finally, as the Soviet Union began to collapse, the doors to Jewish emigration were opened. Between 1989 and the early 2000s, nearly a million Soviet Jews made Aliyah to Israel. The impact of the arrival of this population dramatically changed the social and demographic landscape of Israel.
What Tsarist Russia was able to do with the publication of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is to give an element of respectability to conspiracy theories around Jewish power and nefarious Jewish dealings to rule the world. Because it was a book, a published book, which ultimately got translated into numerous languages, it had the respectability of a published book. No more just conspiracy theories, but an actual book that tells you the Jews are behind it all. And in fact, the contribution of Tsarist Russia to anti-Semitism had been critical. In Nazi Germany, not a lot was invented about the Jews. Much of it was taken from the protocols. But after World War II, the Soviets, the heirs of Tsarist Russia, as much as they claimed to replace it, they can't be anti-Semitic anymore. They just won over the Nazis. So now they have something else that replaces the old Tsarist anti-Semitism of the protocols, and this is now anti-Zionism. And of course, Soviet anti-Zionism claims to have nothing against Jews, only against Zionism and Zionists. But there is a direct connection. First of all, it's the connection of respectability. Soviet anti-Zionism works through a whole world of publications. It gives academic respectability to the idea that anti-Zionism is a proper discipline. People get PhDs in studying anti-Zionism. The same way that the protocols gave respectability to anti-Semitic conspiracy theories through the publication of a book, anti-Zionism does the same thing by giving it the respectability of academic studies. What Soviet anti-Zionism does is to use a lot of the ideas about Jews and to turn them into ideas about Zionists. The idea of nefarious control of the world. It is Zionist money that gets the United States and other countries to engage in war. It is about the ritual bloodlust, about the libels, the blood libels. So now it's about the Zionist army, always the caricatures showing Israeli soldiers with blood dripping from their hands. It uses a lot of these themes and introduces equations that I've come to call the placard strategy, because you see them on placards in all anti-Israel demonstrations. These placards have very simple equations. Israel, Zionism, sometimes they just draw the Star of David, equal. And the placard strategy of Soviet anti-Zionism has been so successful that everyone knows what's on the other side of those equations. Israel and Zionism equals racism, apartheid, colonialism, imperialism. And those words are chosen not because they reflect anything about the reality of Israel and Zionism. They are chosen because at every moment they reflect what is considered the greatest evil. So in the beginning, Zionism equals imperialism was a very common placard sign. But then imperialism did no longer have the sense of being the ultimate evil, and it became more about apartheid and genocide and Nazism. And we see how this placard strategy works by the fact that the United States in left-wing circles recently added white supremacy. Not because Zionism has anything to do with white supremacy, but because white supremacy is now considered evil in American circles, and therefore that's what you slap next to Zionism, Israel, and the Star of David. The placard strategy was promoted by the Soviet Union as part of its entry into international bodies. With the process of decolonization and many countries entering the Soviet orbit, the Soviet Union was able to promote many of these ideas in international bodies. Hence, the Zionism equals racism resolution of the United Nations in 1975. And the United Nations and international bodies have ever since become the primary areas for the promotion of the placard strategy. The Soviet Union anti-Zionism, of course, had massive impact in the Arab world. We talked about the entry of Nazi anti-Semitic propaganda into the Arab world in the 1930s and 40s. With the Cold War, as the Soviet Union seeks to bring the Arab world into its orbit, many of the people from the Arab world come to be educated in the Soviet Union. Certainly the Palestinian leadership is educated in the Soviet Union. That's where they get their PhDs. Abu Mazen's dissertation in Holocaust denial is part of the process of creating anti-Zionism as a respectable academic discipline. And from the Soviet Union, it gets exported. It gets exported through Marxist left-wing circles in Europe, into Europe in the 70s and 80s. People often wonder what happened in Europe in the 70s and 80s that the left, that used to be very supportive of Zionism and the liberation of the Jews, became anti-Zionist. And people try to understand what happened in Israel in those years, but the answer is quite simple. This is the moment when the anti-Zionist Soviet ideas enter into European left-wing circles. And from the 90s, after the fall of the Soviet Union, this remains the lasting legacy of the Soviet Union to the West. It enters left-wing circles in the UK and ultimately to the United States and Canada, where we see it flourishing today in left-wing academia, social justice circles that all come from these same areas. When you hear people talk about Israel, Zionism equal apartheid, equal white supremacy, anti-Zionism becoming more fashionable, they typically present it as if this is a recent phenomena, a recent realization. Just recently, they realized that Israel and Zionism equal apartheid or white supremacy. But in truth, in saying those things, they are echoing Soviet constructions of anti-Zionism that precede them by 60 and 70 years. To summarize the various anti-Zionisms that we've studied throughout the course, I assigned the students the reading of an essay by my colleague Shani Moore on three anti-Zionisms. In that essay, Shani differentiates between three types of anti-Zionisms, which he calls Alpha, Beta, and Gamma, that broadly reflect Jewish anti-Zionism, Arab and Muslim anti-Zionism, and Christian and its secularized visions of anti-Zionism. In discussing Jewish anti-Zionism, Shani Moore makes it clear that the important thing to remember is that Jews who proposed and supported communism or Bundism or socialism, or whether for religious reasons opposed Zionism, did so out of real concern for Jewish life. And they were all united in their vision that whatever problems Jews faced of modernity in Europe in the 19th and 20th century, the answer should not be the establishment of a Jewish state. Also, their anti-Zionism was not central to their vision. It was just a byproduct of whether they were communists or Bundists, and that meant that they would not be Zionists. What's important about it also is that all these debates of Jewish or alpha anti-Zionism are taking time when there is no Jewish state. The state of Israel is yet to be established. Shani Moore says the verdict of history has been very clear about the failure of these various forms of Jewish anti-Zionisms. So when we have today Jews who try to claim that being a Jewish anti-Zionist is nothing new, and they claim lineage from these older Jewish anti-Zionists at the end of the 19th and early 20th century, they kind of conveniently set aside the fact that we're doing it at a time when the state of Israel already exists. It's basically nostalgia. It's like being a loyalist in New England before the American Revolution. Those were part of the ideas that were debated at the time, but are no more relevant. The second form of anti-Zionism he discusses in his essay is Beta anti-Zionism, the Arab and Islamic anti-Zionism that seeks the annihilation of Israel, that seeks essentially the non-existence of a Jewish state in any borders whatsoever. And we discuss this as the clash that led to the violent conflict between Arab anti-Zionism and the state of Israel. Now here, he makes it clear that Arab anti-Zionism is unique in that it's not a normal response to a conflict. It's not what you have in other conflicts. It is marked by a total worldview of boycotts and terrorism against Jewish communities and a complete rejection of the legitimacy of a state and any borders. It's not just a border dispute. It's about the desire to see a whole country go into non-existence. Then Shani Moore goes on to discuss Gamma anti-Zionism, which is essentially best understood as theological Christian, even when it's secularized either in the West or in the East in the former Soviet Union. This is a total worldview that helps explain the world in simple terms, with Israel as being a country that is born in sin, where everything that Israel does is a sin, and thereby the world is easily divided into good versus evil. Israel is entirely on the side of evil, associated with all things that are evil, from apartheid to Nazism to genocide. There's an element of Holocaust inversion that Shani Moore says gives particular pleasure to European intellectuals to blame Israel for engaging in Nazi atrocities and inverting this way the Holocaust. And all of this is essentially a worldview that puts the Palestinians as the always blameless victims who represent good, and Israel always representing evil. And he makes it clear that there is a continuity between theological Christianity and anti-Semitism that projected on Jews sin and evil, and the continued anti-Zionism of the present that, even though it rises in secular circles, is very much a continuation of that ancient Christian theology, complete with the blood libels, the ritual bloodlust of Jews, and the painting of Jews as nefarious purveyors of evil. The other thing that Shani Moore makes, the argument that he makes in this essay, is that Gamma anti-Zionism uses Jewish anti-Zionism and uses Arab anti-Zionism in order to justify itself, in order to hide the fact that it is a worldview, and to claim as if it is just about legitimate ideas, such as Jews who were anti-Zionists before the establishment of the State of Israel, or Arabs who are anti-Zionists supposedly as a result of legitimate grievances and not as a total worldview.
Before moving on, let's apply the three anti-Zionism theory to a current case study. On October 7th, 2023, Hamas terrorists murdered, maimed, raped, and brutalized thousands of Israelis and kidnapped 240 civilians who they are holding hostage. The ensuing war between Israel and Hamas has been commented on and judged by politicians, political pundits, news outlets, and citizens around the world. The college campus became one of the most hotly contested arenas of debate between supporters of Israel and the Jewish people and anti-Zionists. One anti-Zionist group, Students for Justice in Palestine, or SJP, stands out. SJP claims pro-Israel organizations are missing the context to the horrific Hamas attacks, that nothing about the resistance of October 7th is unprovoked, and that these events do not take place in a void. The statements put out by SJP chapters are clear examples of Gamma anti-Zionism that exploits Alpha anti-Zionism to justify itself and draws on the ideology of Beta anti-Zionism, but has to deny its violent import. To begin, the National SJP organization stated that many people of various faiths and backgrounds, including Jewish scholars, rabbis, and activists, have long criticized and opposed Zionism. People must be able to discuss and debate these issues without being falsely smeared as anti-Semites. Here, SJP refers to Alpha anti-Zionism to justify its ideology and de-link it from anti-Semitism. By claiming that Jewish scholars, rabbis, and activists have long criticized and opposed Zionism, SJP is ignoring the fact that the majority of internal Jewish debates about Zionism ended in 1948. Crucially, it was a debate before the state existed. More than that, Jewish anti-Zionists were deeply concerned with the survival and prosperity of the Jewish people. In their opinion, Zionism just wasn't the answer. SJP is uninterested in the safety of the Jewish people. In their statement about the attack from Gaza, the Georgetown chapter of SJP declared that peace cannot exist without justice, and justice starts with ending the occupation of Palestine. When stating justice starts with ending the occupation of Palestine, what does SJP mean? They are not referring to Israel's military control of the West Bank, nor its blockade on Gaza, which Israel has not occupied since 2005. No, SJP is explicitly stating that justice cannot be attained so long as Israel exists, so long as a Jewish state exists on the land formerly known as Palestine. This form of total rejectionism is derived from the ideological heritage of the Arab world, who completely opposed and then violently fought the establishment and existence of the State of Israel. In addition to claiming Jewish support as justification and drawing on the ideology of Arab rejectionism, SJP couches its anti-Zionism in terms of humanitarianism and larger issues of social justice, casting Israel as the perpetual perpetrator of all the worst sorts of evil. According to SJP, Israel is simultaneously an apartheid regime, a supremacist state, a colonial political project, a perpetrator of war crimes, and a part of the Western hegemony. In other words, to oppose Israel is to support all just and moral causes and to stand with all subjugated people fighting evil in the world. This worldview is totalizing, splitting the entire complex world into good versus evil, oppressor versus oppressed, for simple moral organization. It is unconcerned with criticism or steps towards actual peace. It sees Israel as born in sin, this sin tainting everything it does. And so, as Dr. Wilf says, it is concerned not with what Israel does, but with what Israel is. This worldview is totalizing in a way that inhibited SJP and its supporters from condemning the mass gang rape, murder, mutilation, beheading, burning, and kidnapping of Israelis. After all, Israelis are part of Israel, the token source of everything evil in the world.
The kidnap poster's down.
Fuck Israel, that's why.
Really?
So they've got Zionist propaganda up here.
Why? Propaganda? Why? Why does this bothering you? Tell
I'm
me why.
I'm not getting it with an
why?
Interview. I'm not.
My heart, do your research. Do the history. Cool. You don't know anything.
I'm sorry, Dad.
What are you doing?
To someone.
Why someone was kidnapped. That? Do you understand what you just did?
Is the government helping to find these people?
What the fuck?
Yo!
Hey, what are you doing?
Why are you taking signs of kidnapped people? I don't understand.
Because the whole thing is that,
you know how scary it is to be black and get dragged off for no reason? No, you don't!
Look what you're doing.
Go colonize somewhere else.
You should be ashamed of yourselves. Those are victims of terrorist attacks and you're ripping
these
them off.
Those people didn't ask for their images to be used and like-
Those people didn't ask, didn't ask to be kidnapped.
Who's the hate community you're talking about?
The hate community is this kidnap for Israel.
who are currently being held captive.
And you're promoting Zionism.
I am promoting Zionism. Actually, they came into my people's country and they murdered us.
Colonization? Have you heard of that? I don't think you have.
It's really hard to colonize a country that you're indigenous to.
Don't. Yes, they are real. Yes, they are real. These people were kidnapped.
Why don't you look up your phone?
IDF rapes children, honey.
One of the most fascinating phenomena that we have in recent years, especially with the signing of the Abraham Accords, the normalization agreements between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, and the beginning of elements of normalization with other countries like Saudi Arabia and Oman, what we're beginning to see in the Arab world is a certain exhaustion with decades of Arab anti-Zionism. And much of the tragedy that is at this moment is that as anti-Zionism is rising in certain circles in the West, it is actually beginning to wane in some places in the Arab world. After the Abraham Accords were signed, I co-wrote an op-ed with two young Emiratis, a young man and a young woman. And the op-ed opened with a declaration that they're proud Arabs and proud Muslims and Zionists. And they went on to say that they see no contradiction between a proud Arab identity, a proud Muslim identity, and the support of the Jewish right to self-determination in the ancient homeland. In fact, the naming of the Accords Abraham points to this change. If the dominant narrative in the Arab world is still the misdiagnosis of Israel as a white European settler colonial state, as foreigners who invaded a foreign land to which they had no connection, this is still the dominant narrative in the Arab world. For the first time, we have a competing narrative that looks at the Jewish state, looks at Israel, and says, Abraham. And for Muslims and Arabs to look at Jews and say Abraham is to essentially acknowledge the Jews in Israel as kin, not as foreigners, but as people who share a common history and lineage and belonging to the region. If we spoke about Christian Zionism emerging from the reimagining of the ghetto miserable Jews as the ancient Israelites, the descendants of warriors and kings, we can talk about an Arab positive view of Zionism in Israel coming from reimagining the Jews from foreigners to indigenous, from outside invaders to people who have a long history in the region and thereby embraced by that. So for me, one of the most optimistic elements of the course is, as we've seen, that Zionism and anti-Zionism can be supported from the same roots. You could have Jewish religious ideas support Zionism and anti-Zionism, Christian religious ideas support Zionism and anti-Zionism, the idea of the nation state supporting emancipation and supporting Zionism. This gives me hope that in the same way that we've seen the deep sources of Arab and Islamic anti-Zionism, we can also see an era where there will be Arab Zionism, Islamic Zionism, reimagining the Jews from foreigners to kin, from invaders to indigenous. And I personally believe that the rise of Arab Zionism, the rise of an Arab attitude that is positive towards Israel, and one that also embraces Jewish life, that seeks to reverse the fact that Arab anti-Zionism led to the disappearance of Jewish life from the Arab world, seeks to renew Jewish life in the Arab world through the support of Israel and Zionism. I believe that the rise of this possibility of Arab and Islamic Zionism will also finally lead our region to peace.
So the idea of the good and the bad Jew is a theme that we've seen throughout. In Assimilation, the good Jew gives up their Judaism is a Jew at home and a man on the street and does everything to completely integrate and look like every other citizen in the European country that they're in. Even in the communism movement, Lenin differentiates between the good and the bad Jew, the good Jew that fights for social utopia without identities versus the bad Jews who join the Bund. So how has this idea of the good and the bad Jew mutated today, and what is its manifestation?
So one of the most prominent ways that we see it today is among those who are trying to promote anti-Zionism in left-wing circles. They are trying to drive a wedge among Jews. The way to drive a wedge is to create the idealized image of the good Jew as the anti-Zionist, and therefore Jews who are anti-Zionist will get more platformed, will get displayed as the ones that are kind of given the right to speak in various left-wing circles. And the good Jew will be the one who will speak against Israel, who will not only kind of not care about Israel, that's no longer enough. It used to be enough for Jews to say, just leave me alone, you know, I don't care about Israel. Now, for Jews to be considered the good kind of Jews in certain circles, left-wing circles, progressive circles, they have to engage in almost exorcism ceremonies, like public displays of their complete hatred to Israel and Zionism, and thereby they show their credentials as the good Jew. And this is how you drive a wedge, by telling Jews, if you want to belong to our circles, if you want to be associated with ideas of social justice and the good society, then we expect you to go through this ceremony in order to get the label of the good Jew, and then you can come in.
And why is it that anti-Zionism is so strong on the left? What is it about the progressive space that makes this such a home for it?
The response to that is really the Soviet Union, which might appear odd, but it really goes back there. All the Marxist ideas, the Soviets' idea, the left-wing ideas get developed there, and anti-Zionism becomes an important organizing principle. It's a way to often get coalitions to work together that would otherwise not work together. And then it gets exported to left-wing circles in Europe and from there to the West. So it really begins there. The classic anti-Semitism that you see in right-wing circles has been discredited during World War II in left-wing circles. So today we forget that, but anti-Semitism, when it emerged and we discussed it, when we discussed Herzl, it was at the time considered progressive and modern and very popular among students on campuses. That's where Herzl encounters it. And it was the ideology of the future. Today we think of anti-Semitism as the ideology of the deplorables. People who are involved in academia and journalism on campuses and social justice circles, it's always, I mean, they would never think of themselves as ever engaging in anything that is anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic. And what anti-Zionism does is afford the mask of respectability. This is what the Soviet Union worked so hard to create this aura of respectability, the same way it did with publishing the book of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It created this whole academic network to give anti-Zionism a respectable mask as if it's a real academic discipline. And this allows for the political organization of various groupings around those left-wing ideas, with anti-Zionism as something that they can all share in common.
People were very quick to point out, and correctly so, during COVID, that the anti-China rhetoric that was going around could easily lead to anti-Asian hate. So why is this so different for Jews and anti-Israel rhetoric?
When you have problems with other countries, generally it's understood by people that this should not lead to actions against people in your own country who share the same nationality or the same ethnicity or historical background. At one point, I've struggled for many years with the question of, at this moment, what is the difference between the anti-Semitism that comes from right-wing circles and the anti-Zionism that rises in progressive and left-wing circles. There's no question that the anti-Semitism on the right is lethal, and Jews get killed by anti-Semitic attacks. But it's also very clear that it is the enemy from without. So it's like crime. You know you might be a victim of crime. It could be lethal. But criminals are not your social circles. So you understand crime as a threat that is from the outside. Anti-Zionism, I feel, is much more like domestic violence because it uses the mask of respectability against you in your home. What is the home? It's places that Jews even built, social justice circles, academia, journalism, places where Jews have come to prominence. And there, in the places the Jews have come to consider their home, that's where the assault takes place. And the assault takes place by their colleagues, fellow students, professors in university, fellow activists for social justice. And the assault takes place under the mask of respectability of anti-Zionism. So anti-Zionism always translates into an assault on Jewish life. And the problem is that over the years, the question has been asked, is anti-Zionism anti-Semitism? And the problem is that when phrasing the question this way, it's enough that you bring out the Satmar Jew. We talked about how the Satmar Jews, the Natura Carta Jews, are being tokenized in order to say, look, it's not about the Jews. You know, we're not against Jews. No one really cares that their opposition to Zionism is a Jewish theological opposition. They serve as very useful protectors against the charge that anti-Zionism is against Jews. So the problem is not the theoretical question. I can make the theoretical case of how anti-Zionism is directly a continuation of anti-Semitism and uses the same themes and the same mechanisms. But at one point I realized that what we need to ask is what happens to Jews when anti-Zionism rises? Rather than ask the theoretical question, ask the practical question, just what happens? And that's what we've discovered, that in the Arab world, when the Arab world organized itself around the principle of anti-Zionism, it became a hostile environment to Jewish life, and within a few short years, no Jews were left across the Arab world. And the Soviet Union, we saw it too. The Soviet Union claimed to be only anti-Zionist. It was not against Jews. But the Jews very clearly knew that it was directed at them, because all you had to do, this is also what happened in the Arab world, all you had to do was say we're against Zionism, not against Jews, but then you blame the Jews for being Zionists, doesn't matter if it was true or not, and then you can basically operate against the Jews. The same thing happened in Eastern Europe, in the Soviet Union. Jews were basically charged with Zionism, and this was how they could be assaulted. And as soon as Jews could leave the Soviet Union, they left. And we see it in Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, in the UK, that it became a hostile environment to Jewish life because he was so obsessed with anti-Zionism and genuinely did not think that it was about being against Jews, but the Labour Party became this cesspool of anti-Jewish hatred. And we've seen it in the Women's March in the United States and other places. Practically, not theoretically, practically, when anti-Zionism rises, it creates a hostile environment to Jews, and ultimately there are no Jews left. So in practice, anti-Zionism is an assault on Jewish life, but because it has the mask of respectability, it's able to assault Jews in the places that they thought they were most safe.
So how do we, in that sense, understand the motivation of the rise of young anti-Zionist Jews today? I'm thinking organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, for example, which their posts get shared on Instagram all the time by non-Jews, and that is also a convenient image to tokenize.
Yeah. That goes to your question about the good Jew. Ultimately, I believe that especially young Jews who turn anti-Zionist are subject to massive social pressure to renounce any connection with Israel, any Zionist identity. They are essentially asked to mutilate their Jewish identity in order to fit in. And that is a very long lineage. When we read Tom Holland's book, Dominion, How Christianity Made the West, he shows how even emancipation in asking the Jews to mutilate the collective element of Jewish life. And he says, if this felt to the Jews like an ultimatum, is because it was. And he says, this goes all the way back to Paul and how the Jews were expected to essentially become Christian. So this has a very, very long lineage. The Jews are subject to pressure by surrounding societies that are majority non-Jewish to mutilate their Jewish identity in order to be accepted, in order to fit in. And what we see is that the pressure is so intense and the desire to fit in is so large that there are Jews that respond to this pressure by agreeing to mutilate their identity and renounce any connection with Israel and Zionism, and to basically claim in those exorcism ceremonies that they are the good kind of Jew and therefore should be let in.
And so how do we understand Zionism, the word Zionism today? Because we know now that it was a political movement that had a goal and it's achieved its goal. So in that sense, it's finished. And so how do we understand it on the college campus, wherever it's being brought up?
So Zionism, like all liberation movements, does not end when a specific goal is attained, like voting rights for women or civil rights for African Americans or the establishment of the State of Israel for Jews, because liberation movements ultimately have a much broader goal for society at large. It seeks to liberate the larger society from whatever lingering ideas it has about the role of women or the role of Jews. So Zionism was not just about transforming the Jewish condition, which you're right, it did remarkably successfully. So successfully that indeed some Jews can now think that they no longer need Zionism because they forget what it was like to live as Jews before Zionism. So it was very successful in transforming the Jewish condition, but Zionism was far more ambitious, and we remember that from the early texts. It wanted to liberate the world from its obsession with Jews. And in that sense, the role of Zionism is yet to be completed. But in terms of the way that Zionism is today reappropriated by young Jews on campuses, I have found it to be a shorthand for confident Jewish identity. So I think young Jews who realized that anti-Zionism on campuses operates as a form of bullying, that it takes an emotional toll, it's incessant. I spoke about it as kind of a demanding a constant pound of flesh. And whenever Jews agree to say one thing, immediately the goalposts are moved and then they're asked to hand over another pound of flesh. And it's this very incessant dynamic of bullying where when you give in your lunch money, the bully doesn't go away. They just come back for more. And what I found is that young Jews who realized this dynamic of bullying basically realized that the only way to stop it is to reclaim Zionism. Because when bullies are met with confidence, when people tell them, look, I'm a Zionist, so you can't shame me into mutilating my Jewish identity, just go away, then anti-Zionists will go bully other targets, less confident targets. So I found that in the places where Zionism is being reclaimed by young Jews, it's become a shorthand for I'm a confident Jew, so go look somewhere else.
As we finish up, what is it that you hope that our viewers take from everything that we've covered?
First of all, I really hope that the students of this course will have the knowledge, they can follow up and read some of the materials we recommended and really have a sense of confidence in their knowledge of what Zionism is, what anti-Zionism is, directly and not through the various distorted lenses that they often hear about it today. I think it's important also that discourse give them a sense that a lot of the contemporary discourse about Zionism and anti-Zionism has older roots. Because in many ways, a lot of the discourse today about Zionism and anti-Zionism, there's nothing new that is being said. People behave as if they're having new insights, but most of the time they're just echoing ideas that were formulated many decades ago and sometimes many centuries ago. So I think for people to finally see through a lot of that, I think once you see certain things, how the blood libel becomes secularized, you can't unsee it. When you understand the Soviet origins of today's left-wing anti-Zionism, you can't unsee it. So I think what the course gives is really just the ability to cut through a lot of the noise, to see through things. And of course, on a personal level, I really hope that it will help a lot of young Jews feel confident of their Judaism and confident of a Zionist identity.
For me, this was definitely a case of knowledge is power, and the course really did give me a lot of confidence. So thank you so much for everything, and I'm so excited we got to do this.
Thank you to you. This is remarkable.
Thank you for joining us for these 5 episodes of Zionism and Anti-Zionism, the History of Two Opposing Ideas. I really hope this was helpful and answered some of the questions that come with this topic, and that we can continue forward with a slightly better understanding of the contemporary conversation. Thank you.